I'm Lorenzo Butler, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Are you holding out hope for the future? You're not alone. Lawrence psychologist Shane Lopez has made hope his business. Lopez believes that psychological reform in education can promote better student achievement. This hour, we'll talk with Lopez about the role of hope in success, and we'll ask, is hope enough? A high school English teacher tells us what she observes in her classroom and if she sees hope in her students' eyes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. I'm Lorenzo Butler of the Kansas City Public Library. Steve Kraske is away. This is Up to Date. Jim Valvano led the 1983 NC State Wolfpack basketball team to an improbable national title by stressing the same ingredient President Barack Obama used as a rallying point in his unlikely 2008 run to the highest office in the land. The word is hope, and today's guest, senior scientist and KU business professor Shane Lopez, believes that the science of hope shows that how we think about the future is a key determinant of success in school, work, and life. Shane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lorenzo. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. In your latest book, Making Hope Happen, Create the Future You Want for Yourself and Others, your mission is to teach people that investing in their future pays off today, and you research the links between hope, strengths development, academic success, and overall well-being. But does hope work for everyone?
Yeah, it's kind of a universal. So people who are hopeful have a hard time not being successful, but hope takes hard work. So we just don't kind of fall into hope. It's different from wishing, and it certainly is potent and productive. But like I said, it takes hard work.
And in reading your book, I was fascinated by the many stories of the different people in your book. But I was struck by one particular thing, and I was wondering, what's the difference between the hopes of a dreamer and a doer?
Yeah, yeah. And that gets to that notion of hoping and wishing and dreaming, you know, asking people what their dreams are. It's kind of a compelling way to get them to talk about their future, and I'm all for that. But then you have to put some goals around those dreams, and you have to talk about those goals in such a way that you get excited about the future. After that, you have to come up with the plans you need to get to those goals, and then all the hard work and the energy to get there. A lot of people confuse hoping with wishing. Mm. Hoping lasts and it works. Wishing, it's kind of like eating a donut for breakfast, you know? Mm. It feels good when you do it, but it doesn't really give you sustained energy over the course of the day. So it's kind of like mental junk food. And wishing actually undermines the effort you have and the confidence you have and the energy you have to get where you want to go.
And so your theory of hope kind of came to you rather suddenly one day in the office. Can you tell us that story about how this came about?
I sure will. I want to credit my mentor. I took a class that was partly in hope back in the day, and his name was Rick Snyder at the University of Kansas. So I learned a little bit about hope from him in the beginning, but not – I wasn't paying enough attention. So it wasn't until I was working with a client at the Leavenworth VA Medical Center that I learned that, number one, not all smart people have great lives, because I had kind of told myself this story that intelligence is what determined our productivity and happiness. But number two, once we have a break with the future, once we, in a sense, kind of lose focus on where we want to go in life, we become hopeless. And that's what happened to my client, John. And once I saw that a smart person, smart, hardworking person could really become hopeless in a heartbeat, I learned how valuable hope was and really how, in a sense, how unimportant smarts were for him.
Okay. And in the appendix of the book, you list the two hope scales used in research as the adult trait hope scale and the children's hope scale. Mm-hmm. How were these developed?
Yeah, yeah. And that was the work of Rick Snyder. And all hope researchers throughout the world have followed his lead, and we continue to use those scales in research. He went around the world basically looking for hope and trying to figure out what hope was. And interestingly, Kansas and Missouri were kind of hotbeds for understanding how we think about the future. And so he kind of roamed around the Midwest and asked people, what's hope? And he learned that it was thinking about the future in a way that you think the future will be better than the present, but also thinking that you have some control over making that future a reality. And those are the pathways and agency of hope. So once he learned that, he went about trying to develop a scale, and that's kind of where the boring psychometrics of being a researcher come into play, where you test just a ton of items to determine what measures hope and what doesn't. And then you perfect that scale over the years so that you're truly getting at the real meaning of hope when you ask people questions. But what I like to do is kind of more conversationally, I do ask people, you know, what are your hopes for the future? And I kind of look for where that excitement is. Mm-hmm. And once they start talking about something that's compelling to them, once they start telling a story, I then ask them, well, how will you get there? How will you make that happen? And that's where that pathways language comes into play. And then I talk about, okay, when you're stuck, who's going to help you or how will you figure your way out? And that's where that agency language comes into play. So we can kind of put the pieces together through a research scale or through everyday conversations.
And you also do a head, heart, holy measurement as well.
Head, heart, holy test of hope. It's kind of a crowd pleaser. And it gets people thinking about what hope is in their lives. Mm-hmm. Because a big question people ask me is, where does hope come from? For some people, it's purely faith-based. For some people, it's purely cognitive. And for some people, it's just this feeling that wells up in their hearts. So to kind of start that conversation about hope and to introduce our thinking about hope, I ask people to kind of take both hands, put them by their sides, and your listeners can do this right now, put them by the sides of their heads, basically, raise them up. And then when I ask you, where does your hope come from? You just point using your fingers to where you think hope comes from, your head, your heart, are the holy, wherever you think the holy is in your life. So on
now
three.
You do give them two options.
They
can pick two.
They can pick two because they have, you know, hopefully, you know, if all is healthy and good, they have two hands they can use and they can point to where hope comes from. So if we do this right here in the studio, Lorenzo,
I did last night, yes.
All right, where does your hope come from? So point to the head, the heart, or the holy. All right, so Lorenzo's pointing to his heart and to
the holy.
The holy. And that is your story of where hope comes from. And that works for me. Now we need to figure out how can you leverage that hope? How can you make more hope happen in your life so that you can do better at school, work, and in your family?
Now, and in reading the book as well, you know, I was struck by the fact that a lot of the theory of hope seemed to come out of people who somehow had strong support systems. Mm-hmm. What about the people that have no sense of hope? Mm-hmm. The word itself, you know, what it entails. What do you say to those who have never experienced hope have no support system at
all? Sure. What's most characteristic of people without hope is, number one, they don't have anything they're excited about in the future. They may have had that at one time, but then circumstances may have taken that away. Number two, they don't have people around them. So they don't have people they could borrow hope from. And number three, they've kind of given up telling stories about their lives that may build more hope over time. So we have to intervene at some point. I get a lot of parents who call me and they call in and they talk about their child lacking hope and having no friends at school, let's say. And then we work hard as a team trying to find that one thing that kid is excited about, that one thing a child's excited about. Because as you mentioned, hopeful people have a support system. Well, it's a chicken and the egg thing. Mm. Do they have a support system because they're hopeful, or are they hopeful because they have a support system? So, you know, when we look at this more closely, we find that hopeful people do attract resources to them. But people who are excited about the future, let's say a leader who makes other people enthusiastic about the future, he or she can bring people to them quite quickly. So again, we try to find, instead of saying, okay, let's help him go get some friends, we say, okay, what's one thing you're excited about regarding the future? And then let's have that future vision pull you forward And as you get moving, hopefully people will come around you and support you.
Awesome. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Lorenzo Butler of the Kansas City Public Library. We're talking with psychologist Shane Lopez about hope and his latest book, Making Hope Happen, Create the Future You Want for Yourself and Others. We're also going to be joined in a few minutes by Kristen Blunt, who's an English teacher and adjunct professor as well. Shane Lopez speaks this evening at 6 in UMKC's Pearson Auditorium, which is 5000 Home Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Visit the up-to-date page of kcur.org for more information. And can you think of a time in your life when hoping for something translated to success? Have you ever had a time when adopting a hopeful attitude toward a tough situation made it better? We'd like to hear your stories. So if you have a question about hope for psychologist Shane Lopez, give us a call. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And Shane, just going back to that point really quickly. You were talking about parents who have children with no hope. But I'm struck in Kansas City specifically by those who have parents, but the parents don't have hope.
Right.
And then you have students or children that don't see hope around them, don't see hope from their parents, actually see the what might be the opposite of hope, what's based in your book. How do you address that? And, I mean, they obviously might not know to come to you.
So how
can they find hope?
Lorenzo, you're absolutely right. Hope is contagious. So we've found through the work of Nicholas Christakis, who's demonstrated kind of the connectedness of hope and happiness, that hope is contagious to the third degree. So your friend's friend's friend is affected by your hope. But so is hopelessness. So if you're hopeless, you are modeling and transmitting hope to other people accidentally, to an extent, subtly and accidentally. So when we think about folks who are surrounded, let's say, by hopeless adults, that's a real tragedy, because that's they look to adults to inspire that hope in them. So we have to have people who are kind of the hopeful torchbearers, and often it's teachers. And we've just had this wonderful experience, and I'm looking forward to hearing from Kristen, this wonderful experience of identifying high hope schools across the country. And this was based on their Gallup student poll results, where we measure hope across the country. And we'd call up the principals and say, hey, congratulations, you're a high hope school. And we tell them a lot about that. And then we'd say, can you nominate the most hopeful teacher in your school? And in a heartbeat, they're like, oh, yeah, I know exactly who I'll nominate. So these hopeful people kind of make themselves known. And that one hopeful teacher in a school, let's say, can really transmit hope to hundreds of kids. So it takes one caring adult who is excited about the future, hopeful about the future, to affect a whole large group of children. But to get back to the circumstances that you described, we have to figure out ways to make adults in our community excited about their own futures and give them the resources they need to pursue those futures in real ways.
Absolutely. Looks like we have a caller. We have Chris in Lawrence, who wants to talk about the medical aspects of hope. Chris, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much for taking my call. I always enjoy this show. Today is particularly meaningful to me.
Thank you.
Because I am a an end-stage liver disease patient who requires a transplant in order to save my life. I was diagnosed about 2 years ago, and I lost an entire year just in part of the condition of my disease, the confusion, the other problems that I was having, hallucinations, things like that. So one entire year is kind of gone to me. But the doctors, the medical community here in Lawrence and in Kansas City, everybody rallied. Everybody wants to save my life. Senator Pat Roberts' office has been particularly helpful as well. Everybody just came together to save the life of a 54-year-old woman who hasn't been able to work since 2008. So prior to that, I was always a taxpayer, never a high wage earner. But everybody has come forward to help me. And do you know, out of pocket to date, it has cost me exactly $30 in donations, because it's all I've had. And yet every day I wake up hopeful for my future, looking forward to seeing my son, a 14-year Marine Corps veteran who's just returned from overseas, my daughter-in-law, my grandchildren, my, you know, my life. They're out in California right now. But every day I look forward to that day and what's possible that day. And I loved the comment about hope and action. Because one of the things that has given me so much hope is the fact that I am willing to take action. I've filled out paperwork like I can't tell you, you know, especially when it comes to Social Security and my disability and needing medical assistance through Medicaid, things like that. These things are all coming forward because I've always taken the next step that needed to be taken in order to keep things moving forward. And that's been a huge part of it for me, is that I don't just lay here and wallow and, oh, my God, I'm going to die, because I'm not. I'm bound and determined. And it's the hopefulness in my life is what's saving my life.
And, Chris, you also mentioned, was it prayer that also helped you?
Oh, my goodness sakes, yes. From my family members, from my community members, from my doctors even, you know, from strangers that I've met that recognize that I need help, that, you know, maybe at a grocery store somebody will say, I'll keep you in my prayers. I feel them. I feel those prayers. Many hands, you know, make light work, and I feel the elevation in my own spirit because so many people are willing to help me.
And Shane, what do you think about that with prayer in the community?
Yeah, Chris tells a compelling story about how her future makes her behave differently today, filling out papers and rallying the troops and getting other people by her side. And prayer is a part of it. So again, with that head, heart, holy test of hope, faith is an important part of hope for many people. And acknowledging that and doing whatever works for you is an important message that I think people should take away. So hope is bolstered by hard work, as Chris pointed out. But for some people, building a community, a faith community, can really help them move past all the obstacles they have in life.
And thanks for the call, Chris. We appreciate it. Up next, we have Tom calling from KCK.
My question is in reference to motivational speakers and perhaps televangelists. Should we put hope in what they're saying and perhaps some of these suggestions that they recommend? In fact, there was a program a couple of years ago called The Secret. And
oh,
I often wonder about that.
Yeah, you got me going now. the Secret, it's interesting. So the same publisher that published Making Hope Happen published The Secret. I think The Secret, unfortunately for my publisher, I think The Secret is the most caustic cultural phenomenon in the past 10, 20 years. What The Secret encourages you to do is wish. It encourages you to manifest something in your life by wishing really hard and then rallying the troops around that wish. Well, it doesn't take hard work to wish. And motivational speakers have a role in our society, certainly, and that's to make us enthusiastic about the future. But then we have to kind of pick up the ball from that point forward.
Yeah, your hope theory seems to be much more, it seems to be centered much more on someone who is taking their life in their own hands, taking responsibility for their life, understanding the obstacles that are in front of them and overcoming those obstacles.
Exactly.
So it's very, very different.
And just thinking about the future in a wishful way doesn't get you moving. You know, it actually kind of it undermines the energy you have for life. So when you're hopeful and you develop these pathways and all the energy you need and all the resources you need to get things done, you keep moving and you actually build this upward spiral of health and well-being and productivity. So it's exactly opposite of what wishing does, which can send us on a downward spiral.
And a quick comment on televangelists and the balance between what they're saying and, I guess, reality.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the televangelist. You know, I think some of them, many of them have very hopeful messages, but then they encourage you to take action. So just like a politician who has a hopeful message, if he or she doesn't encourage you to take action in your own life or compel you to do so in some meaningful way, then they're really not helping you all that much. So the extent to which we get these affirming messages from the media, that's great, but we have to follow through and take responsibility for our own hope in our lives.
And thanks for the phone call, Tom. We appreciate it. And so, Shane, just in general, when someone comes into your office, what is it about them that lets you know that they are a hopeful person? What is it about them that kind of gives you the direction that you need to explore the hope theory?
Yeah. When I was listening to Chris, I was thinking about that when she was talking about her pursuit of health and you know, she said, I was energized and good things started to happen. Well, hopeful people, they just look different. It's interesting. You know, I'm a senior scientist at Gallup, so I'm all about the data. But as a psychotherapist, I'm very interested in how people look and feel. Hopeful people are excited about the future. They love telling stories about what they're up to. They pull people to the cause. They're not afraid to ask for help. And they are on the move. So they just hold themselves in a whole different way. And quite frankly, if we look at kind of the outcomes of hope, they do better in school, they do better at work, and they're happier people.
You're listening to Shane Lopez, and he's discussing his book, Making Hope Happen. If you have questions for Shane, give us a call. Our number here is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org. Now, Shane, the other thing that struck me while reading your book, one of the questions that popped into mind was, in order to be successful through what's essentially the hope method, what does one need before he or she has hope? So when they come into your office and they are not hopeful, what is it that they need before?
Yeah, it's kind of dry, but it's important. People need to understand the connection between if and then. And you'd be surprised how many people struggle with contingency thinking. So, and we teach this pretty effectively in good grade schools. We teach the connection between if I do this, then that will happen. And people sometimes who don't learn it in grade school pick it up in pool halls because you can learn if-then thinking by playing pool. And a lot of folks struggle with kind of the amount of responsibility they have in their lives, mainly because they don't understand contingencies. They don't understand how their behavior affects other people and how the behavior of other people affect them. So we often start there and trying to ferret out, you know, to what extent do you understand how causality works and if-then thinking works in your own life. But it always comes back to how excited you are about the future. Because folks who are lacking that, you know, we have to figure out that one thing that helps them be excited about the future, because that's what pulls us forward through the daily hassles that can overwhelm us.
Yeah, I was struck by the if and then theory in the book, and you were talking about something as simple as, you know, dealing with your son and being on a playground and yeah. You know, I will grab the monkey bars. I will make my way across the monkey bars. It was interesting to me that everyone should have that thought process, but it doesn't seem as though that happens. And the other thing about that is, you know, we have recently had an incident with our mayor 2 days ago in which we had a citizen who ran for Missouri State Representative who had an unsuccessful run in 2012. But he jumped on stage and disrupted the entire state of the city speech. He had angry words afterward and during the disruption. He seemed very frustrated. But in watching him campaign in 2012, he seemed to give out great hope to a lot of kids and to his fellow man. How do you address that? If he was a patient in your office, what would you say to someone who seemed to be full of hope but has almost seemingly lost that hope?
Yeah. And that's like the patient John I was describing earlier. He kind of lost that connection with this compelling story that was pulling him forward through life. And that compelling story for that former candidate involved being a functioning politician. And when that was no longer a reality, sometimes people lose their way because that was pulling them forward. And because of that story they were telling themselves, they were behaving in their best interest today. So once he lost that goal, that vision of the future, some people lose their way and they start behaving in odd ways or not the most productive or healthy ways usually. So that sudden break with the future is like a breakup. It involves a lot of overwhelming emotions, a lot of confusion, he probably lost his understanding of how he can affect the world.
Well, evidently he lost it for all of 40 seconds because the next day he did announce that he's going to run for mayor in 2015. So how does that happen? You know, how do you have someone who's hopeful, loses hope, and somehow after getting removed from a stage regains hope for the future?
Yeah, it's not that hope is not that ephemeral. It doesn't kind of go in and out.
Yeah.
For that particular individual, you know, there may be some other things going on in his life that influenced his behavior quite a bit. But hope is pretty stable. But what's also interesting is that it's malleable through intentional effort. In other words, we can teach hope to children. We can teach hope to adults. A friend of mine did a study out at Santa Clara University. He did a 90-minute hope intervention and was able to boost hope in college students, and that was sustainable over time. So hope is more of a trait-like thing, but it's also malleable, so it can be changed. So it's very interesting, but I don't think it goes in and out based on who's on stage.
Sure. Great. Now it's time for a break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation about hope with psychologist Shane Lopez. And we'll also talk with a high school English teacher and adjunct professor about whether or not she sees hope in her students' eyes. I'm Lorenzo Butler, and for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Lorenzo Butler in for Steve Kraske. We're talking with psychologist Shane Lopez about hope and his latest book, Making Hope Happen, Create the Future You Want for Yourself and Others. We're also joined in studio right now by Kristen Blunt, who is an English teacher, chairs the English department at Ruskin High School and is an adjunct professor at Baker University. Kristen, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
So we were talking before the break about a number of different aspects of hope. We were talking about the medical side. We were talking about education and children. And in your book, I was glad to see that you touched on children a mm-hmm. lot in terms of hope. Mm-hmm. And so, Kristen, I want to kind of turn this to you as well. You have seen and heard a little bit of what Dr. Lopez has discussed. But do you see hope in your students on a daily basis?
Absolutely. And I think if I didn't, I couldn't continue what I do. I am loving what Dr. Lopez is saying about hope and it being hard work. I think in education, not only as the profession, but with students, there's a lot of wishing that's mm-hmm. happening. And sometimes that hope is depleted, or it can be depleted when we see setbacks. So that setback could be a lack of resources. It could be test scores. It could be grieving in the community. But what I also see quite a bit of is resiliency mm-hmm. in that. And so that resiliency helps us to continue to do the work that we need to do, fight the good fight.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Dr. Lopez, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm smiling because Kristen is a hopeful teacher, and she's spreading hope throughout her community, not just in her classroom, and she's teaching hope along the way, and that's what we found through our work at Gallup, and specifically in Gallup Education, is that we need more talented, hopeful teachers, and those folks can help us change communities.
And can you explain a little bit about the program that you're starting? I know one is Ripples of Hope, but you're also starting a program that's based toward education. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, more specifically about the Gallup student poll that we've surveyed now 1.5 million students in America. Every fall, every school in America can turn on the Gallup student poll and at no cost measure the hope, engagement, and well-being of students grades 5 through 12. So you could actually look at hope more closely in your student body as a teacher, as a principal. So I encourage all folks to kind of turn on Gallup Student Poll, go to gallupstudentpoll.com to make that happen. But what we found through that, and Kristen, I don't know if this is true for your students, but what we found across the country is that hopeful students are more likely to go to school. they're more likely to show up. Have you seen that?
Oh, of course. Of course. And more hopeful teachers are also likely to come to school and be happy to be there. Yeah. I think that it's an interesting environment, and I do think that it starts with the adults. I love that you said that. It's hope is contagious, mm-hmm. and it's infectious. And so I certainly see a difference between the teachers who are a little bit hardened by what's going on around them and what their classrooms look like versus the teachers who are enthusiastic. They see something bigger. They see that bigger picture. And despite the setbacks, they keep persevering, mm-hmm. and their students pick up on that.
Excellent. Now, if there are any other teachers that are on spring break, possibly right now, not in the classroom, and they're out there, would like to talk about the role of hope in their classroom, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And Kristen, what can we as a society do to help hopeful teachers in trying to instill hope into students?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think that a lot of it has to do with being involved, and I know this is going to sound very cliche, but I'm a huge advocate of community involvement within the schools. As a teacher, I feel like I cannot do it alone. That's what society wants me to do. I think parents want me to do. My administrators want me to do. I want us all to do. And so whenever I can to bring someone into the classroom, I want students to see, this is what this person is doing. Look how great they are. Look how far they've come. And so as teachers, I guess my call out there is to invite people into your classroom so that your students can see models of hope, models of success, just besides their boring old teacher who's, you know, talking about text features or whatever the case may be. I think that it's really important that students see examples of what that looks like in different walks of life.
We were talking to a High Hope principal 2 weeks ago on an interview, and I asked him, I said, how do you get parents involved in the community, involved in schools? He goes, that's our talent pool. That's our talent pool. That's how we change lives, is every parent has a talent. We want them to come over and share that talent with our students. So just that notion of viewing parents and the community as resources, I think it's pretty powerful.
Excellent. Let's go to the phone lines right now. We have Gabriella in KCMO. Gabriella, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Good. I am a dog trainer, and I use positive reinforcement training with my animals, and I teach it to my clients. And I was wondering how schools have started to take on that sort of operant conditioning, but using it in positive reinforcement ways to cultivate better results with their students and maybe even their teachers. I was just wondering how, you know, that plays a role in everyone's lives with making them more hopeful.
Fantastic question. Thank you very much.
I'm smiling here because I had a lot of back and forth with folks who were saying, are animals hopeful? And I would say, no. But my dog's hopeful. I promise you, Shane, my dog is very hopeful. And in fact, unfortunately, animals don't have the capacity for hope. They don't have the brain structure to be hopeful creatures. But boy, they sure can learn. And I learned from a lot of people who train animals about how to care and how to be compassionate to animals and teach them along the way. So in teaching classroom management classes over the years, I've learned that teachers are very good at employing operant conditioning and other classroom management techniques if they're hopeful about the outcome, if they're hopeful about the work they're doing every day. So you take a low-hope teacher, and Kristen and I have met a few in our days, you take a low-hope teacher and you give them great techniques and you give them great training, they have a hard time pulling it off. They have a very hard time pulling it off. So what we need, again, are more talented, hopeful teachers, because then they take that resource that might be positive reinforcement and learning how to do that really well, and they turn it into a strategy that's amazingly effective. But that same resource in the hands of someone with low talent and low hope is not effective at all.
It's very interesting. Dr. Lopez has certainly hit the nail on the head with that. In both the state of Kansas and the state of Missouri, and I believe it's nationwide, there is a system in place called PBIS in which it's about speaking positively as a staff and as a student body, and also teaching our community how we will speak to each other, how we will respect each other. And there's certainly tenets of that. And the idea is if we speak it, then we will create it and we will do it. And it's interesting to see the buy-in of it. There's always like a 20-60-20 split we speak of in education, where 20% will buy in and 60% fall on the fence and 20% are like, no way. There's no possible way me being, you know, peppy and happy all the time is really going to make a difference. But as we integrate the language and we all have that common language, that 20 falls into the 60, that 60 falls into the upper 20, and it does make a difference. And you see attitudes change. It's remarkable.
All right. And we have Stephanie here from Overland Park, Kansas, who's an educator. Stephanie, you're on the line.
Well, good afternoon, or good morning. It's almost afternoon. I'm just so happy to hear that you keep saying that you're smiling. So I love that Kansas City is making you smile with hope. I'm a virtual educator in the state of Kansas. I work for Lawrence Virtual School, and we see so many children who have lost hope in their regular brick-and-mortar classrooms, and we're able to provide a resource for families to take control back in their home of their child's learning process. We have children who are needing to be challenged, and that's just a little too challenging sometimes for the regular brick-and-mortar classrooms. Or we have children who have been bullied extensively and are losing hope in themselves and in life. And we have children with special needs who are their needs are not being able to be met by funding cuts. And then we have just a variety of children that come to us for a variety of needs. And we're really feeling our population increases dramatically every year. And it's just exciting to be able to participate in educating students in a different way virtually to provide them with the hope that's being lost.
Thank you very much. Shane, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Stephanie ended there on a great note, a different way. I think the struggles we have in American education system, they involve our students, but it also involves the system. So our students, based on a 2003 study that was done internationally, our students have more confidence than any other group of children in the world. So they're very high on confidence and will. But then when you ask them, what will you do to make the future happen for yourself, they struggle with the ways. And I think our education system's a lot like that, too. We're very confident that we can make things better. We're looking for the next moonshot, and we're going to go after it together, and we're very willful. But when it comes to the ways, we need more ways. Virtual school is a good way to meet the needs of more students. Project-based learning is a good way to meet the needs of more students. All the after-school programming in Kansas City is a good way to meet those needs. So we need more ways. We've got enough will. We just need more ways.
Well, and this is a question for both of you, how do you convince a superintendent who, you know, maybe 30 years into education and into a certain way to educate students? How do you convince them that hope is something that's very viable?
I'm going to let Kristen tackle that one first.
Oh, boy. I think that getting the ear of the superintendent is probably the first step. Aside from that, I think that that's when you are showing what's happening in the classroom. I always go back to showing and, you know, providing examples. I know that leaders of schools and school districts, as well as our government officials, have other aspects to think about. And sometimes teaching and learning is not always top of that list. They have to think about budgets and bureaucracy. I just like to kindly remind people that, you know, we're here about student learning first. And so if, you know, with Dr. Lopez's amazing research, I think, how can we ignore that? How can we ignore that, you know, this is a fundamental aspect of what will make our students successful?
And that's what we do. We try to wow the superintendents with numbers. So they're interested in budgets and test scores, numbers, money, test scores. Right. So we throw more numbers at them. Like half the students in America are hopeful, half are not. A hopeful student will do one letter grade better than a low hope student of the equal intelligence. So one letter grade better. Hopeful students are more likely to go to school. So we try to wow them with data. Of the hopeful students in America, 75% of them are engaged in school. Hopeful students are more likely to graduate on time. So we tell this story in such a way that it sits alongside the budget numbers and the test score numbers. And then we try to grab their attention and then demonstrate how hopeful students can influence the test scores and how good test scores can attract more money because more people are coming to town to go to your school. So that's what we try to do. We try to wow them with the research, but it's a tough road. I mean, superintendents are somewhat distractible. So we work with people like Kristen, and we get enough of them kind of telling the story of hope that it's hard to ignore over time.
If you're just now joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Lorenzo Butler, and in studio with me I have psychologist Shane Lopez, who is discussing his book, Making Hope Happen. We also have Kristen Blunt, who is a local educator. If you have questions for us, give us a call. Our number is 816-235-2888. It's 816-235-2888. And we've been talking a lot about education for the past several minutes, and I think it's interesting as well, and I think this might tie into education, but, you know, America in this century is under the worst economic times, mm-hmm. arguably, in our history. Mm-hmm. When you discuss hope with people, and, you know, this is also students who are struggling to get meals and whose parents are working overnight shifts and things of that nature, but how are you greeted by people when you discuss the hope philosophy, especially people who might be unemployed and have no future in their mind?
Well, Kansas City today has been incredibly welcoming, so I appreciate that. I typically receive a very warm welcome because I try to meet people where they are. And if they're suffering and struggling, we talk about that. If they're concerned about, getting into the best college, we talk about that. So people are in different places, and we try to meet them where they are. But what I find is that people are looking for hope. Mm. No matter where they are in their lives, no matter how much money they're making, no matter what struggles they have, one common thing that we have is that we want a better future. We found that to be the case of 84% of the world's population. So at Gallup, we did a study of the world's population, and 84% of people want a future that's better than the present. Which just makes sense. So we all lean in that direction. Now, what's interesting, Lorenzo, is that we've done study after study after study looking at how hope relates to family income and free and reduced lunch percentages within schools. And this might be surprising. We found no relationship between hope and income.
Really?
We find that it's an equal opportunity resource. So people who are thinking about this from the vantage point of, hey, I'm working with kids who don't have a lot of resources. They're like, gosh, I see a lot of hopeless kids. And then they make the link between hope and low resources. But people who are working with a lot of hopeless kids of families with a lot of resources, they're kind of baffled by what's going on. And they kind of blame it maybe on the family or the school or something like that. But we see hope as being evenly distributed across society. Now, when I think about that, I always marvel at the people that I grew up with that, you know, made a meager income last, you know, all month long, mm-hmm. and they gave joy and happiness to their children. So these are folks who are on the low scale.
But is that giving hope as well?
Well, it can be. When you say, okay, we're going to have a better future and we're going to do that together, and we're going to work hard and we're going to sacrifice and we're going to overcome obstacles and we're going to keep moving together as a family unit, and then you're giving hope and joy to your children, I think it is. I think you're modeling hope. And so I'm always, again, amazed at resilience, as Kristen spoke about, the resilience of some people, and hope is a predictor of who's resilient. And I think we can find it everywhere we look, and if we don't find it, then we need to take the hope we have to spare and share that hope with other people.
Okay. And we actually have an email that's come in from a psychologist in Lawrence. And the psychologist asked, can you address the problem of hope among kids and young adults with ADHD? Mm. A lot of kids with ADD have trouble, quote, wanting like the rest of us do. I believe that they become hopeless because they cannot reach the goals they hope for or give up hoping at all, close quote.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure Kristen has worked with some of these students over her career. But yeah, the goal line keeps moving around for students who have ADHD. So that's hard because they're moving in the right direction and then somehow the goal moves. So we have to be there. And these students, frankly, need more support. They need more ways to bolster that will. So people always say, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. For these students, it may be more apt to say where there's a way, there's some will. So we provide more alternatives, more flexibility so that these students can work within those ways to get to the goals that matter to them, even though they're kind of shifting a little bit, and then they can build will over time. But when we throw a student with attention difficulties or any other student who is struggling into, you know, kind of this factory mm-hmm. of education, and there aren't many ways to find, you know, many routes to pursue, then they really struggle because that goal keeps moving in their mind and they don't only see one way that's not for them. And then their will is zapped. So we need to make sure that we're as flexible as we can be within the resources, given the resources we have.
Right. I'm going to go ahead and take a call from Carol in Prairie Village, who's a school psychologist. Carol, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you've already just touched on the issue of resilience. I just wanted to make a comment about the impact that research shows of just having one adult in a child's life who is hopeful and encouraging for that child, and it doesn't need to be a parent or a relative. It can just be a teacher for children who are in difficult home environments. That encouragement and using, you know, for regular kids, typical kids, you know, six praises for every negative comment. Mm. For at-risk kids, the kids that I work with, you know, 13 times, you know, you need to praise, specifically praise. And I think it's really hard. So many of us think that praise needs to be earned in a way rather than just really acknowledging children for the efforts they're making. And I think that's an important thing for educators to think about.
Yeah, Carol brings up an excellent point about resilience, but also that praise and recognition. You know, I mentioned that the secret was that kind of this caustic force in our society. Another one was the self-esteem movement of the 70s. So in California, they funded the self-esteem movement that kind of rippled across America, and we praise children for waking up in the morning, you know, and we kind of lost our way when it came to praise. And now adults need to relearn how to praise children. And we ask a question on the Gallup student poll about praise and recognition for good schoolwork in the last 7 days. And kids are saying they don't get enough. And I believe them. Unfortunately, when we ask parents, are you giving your student praise and recognition? They say, oh, yes. And then we ask teachers and they're like, oh, yes. So if we're doing it, we're not doing it in a way that is effectively communicating that positive feeling to students. So I think we really need to figure out again how to give good praise and recognition to students because it can make a difference in their schoolwork.
Carol, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Just the last question here, and this is for both of you. And I'll ask you first, Kristen. When will we have a helpful world?
I think we have a helpful world now. And I feel very confident in saying that I see, again, mm-hmm. examples of Kansas Cityans, you know, global citizens being kind and loving and extending a hand to each other. And I think that is because, very fortunately, we do see hope being on a continuum. It just continues. And so I don't think that we necessarily have to wait for a helpful world. I think it's here now. I think it's about perception and maybe opening up that perception to others and exposing more and providing more examples to kids, students, in schools, in the community, that it's here and it's attainable. Mm-hmm. It's attainable for them.
And I think, you know, I'm ballparking this, but probably about half of people in Kansas City are hopeful. And what can those people do to help the other half be hopeful? That's what I'd love your listeners to think about today. And they're very small ways. Like the easiest way to help someone be hopeful is eliminate an obstacle that's in their way. Gosh, we put up obstacles all the time to people. And how can we eliminate one obstacle to someone's goal today?
Yeah.
That would be incredibly powerful. But also telling your stories of hope. And that's a great way to teach is through stories and narratives and modeling. And that's easy to do every day. So I believe if we become more intentional, those of us with hope to spare, if we become more intentional about sharing hope, we could go from 50% in the community to 60%. And then hope has a way of making ripples. So if that ripple starts in Kansas City, it kind of moves out across Missouri, across Kansas, and then we become a more hopeful part of the country. And guess what happens? More hopeful people then join in because they want to live in a hopeful place. So you'll really attract more people to this place, and then it'll become easier to be hopeful.
Fantastic. Kristen Blunt, an English teacher at Ruskin High School. Shane Lopez, a psychologist and professor of business at the University of Kansas. I really appreciate both of you coming in today. Shane's latest book is Making Hope Happen, Create the Future You Want for Yourself and Others. He will speak this evening at 6 in UMKC's Pearson Auditorium, which is at 5000 Home Street in Kansas City. You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, we'll take a look at Google Fiber's complicated relationship with Kansas City. Also, when bread's off the table, what goes on yours? We'll talk Passover provisions and get the latest chapter of A Fan's Notes. This show was produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Lorenzo Butler, and for Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.